Good morning, everyone. It's good to see you guys. Congratulations again. I know they've already gone, but to our graduates, so special to have that gathering back. My son graduated 2 years ago, which was just weird. It was like virtual online, right? Like Zoom graduation. So like felt so good to be back. It's interesting, though. I've been to so many of these. I've been here at the church for 20 years in the community, started out in youth ministry, and so I would go to the graduations every single year. And it's interesting to see today a bit of maybe a diminished optimism in the ceremony. And I think it is, in many ways, a sign of our times where these kids are coming out of there with all this passion and vision and at the same time this sort of sobriety, right? Looking at the world that we live in today. And I was thinking about that for these kids because I'm like, I've got skin in the game, right? This is my daughter here. So like I'm invested in this future here for these kids. And thinking about what really is at stake, what kind of is the plan ahead of them. And, you know, I got to do Friday night, the blessing of the artists here in town, which is just a sweet Laguna tradition that they do every single year, which none of you are at, by the way, you artists. I know who you are. It was a little light this year, but that's okay. But I was thinking about that, thinking about my daughter, thinking about our church and what we're here to do. And it reminded me of one of my favorite quotes, which is by Dostoevsky, where he says, "Beauty will save the world." And usually when you see this quote online, you know, his name comes after it, but almost as if he said it, but he didn't say it. He wrote it. It's in one of his just fantastic books called The Idiot, which is such a great title, right? But I love Dostoevsky. His work is about redemption and beauty, but in the midst of all like the hardness of life, and he pulls out this deep, beautiful redemption story, and that book is no different. It's interesting, though, that line isn't spoken in the book. It's attributed to another character, and it's said almost with a sort of naive mockery of Prince Myshkin. The person says he believes beauty can save the world. And you're really wrestling this whole time through this novel with this question. When Myshkin actually speaks about beauty, he says beauty is difficult. He says he's not prepared yet for it. He says beauty is a riddle. And I shared this with the artist because I was saying, you know, what Dostoevsky does is rather than just tell you that beauty will save the world, in a way he shows you that it's by inviting us into the riddle, into the complexity, and he shows us the paradox of it, the mystery of it, the depth of it. And this way of speaking, this way of showing rather than telling to me is how beauty saves the world. That it doesn't just come in and preach, right? It like catches us off guard. There's a quote I like from C.S. Lewis, where he says it steals past the watchful dragons of our orthodoxy or our dogma. That we see the world a certain way, and beauty comes in and like gets to us slant, right? It surprises us. It comes in and sneaks in from where so often we're defensed in being right or having this figured out. And we live in this world that feels so positional and oppositional, and thinking about these students and stepping into that calling and going, oh, that creative beauty within each one, we so desperately need it. And each of you artists, we so desperately need it. And you as church body, we so desperately need it. We need churches that are salty. We need churches that shine light. And Jesus warns us that once we lose that saltiness, we've got real problems, right? And so understanding that, what makes us shine? What makes us shine in such a way that people don't praise us, but praise God? That's the real work. And one of my ways that I feel like I connect so much with beauty, and I know this is not everybody's, but I love poetry. Any poets out there or people? Yeah, okay, no hands went up. So bear with me here. But it does it for me. It catches me off guard and surprises me. And one of my favorite poets is Wendell Berry, who is a theologian, profound poet, and he's a farmer, which to me, there's a purity in that too. But he has this short little poem called The Real Work. And he says, it may be that when we no longer know what to do, we've come to our real work. And that when we no longer know which way to go, we've come to our real journey. The mind that is not baffled is not employed. The impeded stream is the one that sings. In this like wrestling, this complexity, it's part to me of the design and how God works transformation in a world where we sort of obsess for quick answers and solutions. We have a God that invites us to this real work, and often that comes in the bafflement, it comes in the riddle, it comes in the complexity of these things. That this is how Jesus taught, by not making things easy, but instead turning these stories into these parables that we puzzle over and yet pull us into the greater truth. The impeded stream is the one that sings. Makes me always think of the Getty, which is like one of my favorite places to go. And it has this stream that flows through the middle of the kind of courtyard. And it comes in these different sections. And each one, the bottom is a little bit different. And what you get is different tones out of the stream. And I recorded them, and I'm not going to play them for you. But I was like, oh, you hear the music of the water running over these impediments. And I think we go into a world where we can feel a lot of impediment, right? But to go, oh, it's not only doing something within us, it's causing a sort of radiance to ensue, this beauty to come out of our story. And I think Jesus would say this beauty, this is the light that draws us to something greater than ourselves. And as we wrestle, this is where we learn and see. I like how, last week we celebrated Pentecost Sunday, which is the celebration that initially was there when God gave us the law, which was like giving the people of Israel an identity. They came out of slavery. They didn't know who they were. And at this moment, God hands them this Torah and says, this is who you are as a people. And then years and years later, the Holy Spirit comes down and unites and draws this new church together, speaking in everybody's native tongue, giving the gift of the Spirit, empowering the church to go out and do the mission. And I love how Jesus says, go make disciples, go into all the world. And then he leaves, right? Which you're like, wouldn't you have like coached them for a while? I mean, he had given them all this ahead of time, but it was like they were just discovering it for the first time. And then he leaves, but leaves them with his Spirit, leaves them with his example and the model of the cross, this way of downward mobility or humility of leadership. But he teaches them and he's taught them these truths about the kingdom and does it almost entirely in parables, which is a smart strategy, right? Because it's not, again, the simple answer. It's these stories that we sit with and that keep taking us deeper and deeper and deeper. This is what the work is of Jesus' teaching, of revealing the kingdom, is to kind of awaken us to the way things really are, which is why Jesus constantly referred to that, the kingdom coming to earth. That we have this worldly kingdom that we somehow mistakenly take as everything, and that he's trying to open our eyes and our ears to the greater truth of the kingdom. I think about how Isaiah said, for as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts, your thoughts. And these parables show us this higher way of thinking that usually catches us off guard, because this higher way of thinking usually is opposite of what we're thinking. That the things that we assume are correct, it's actually the very opposite way. The things that we trust, the things that we're drawn to, the things that we associate with like power and control and success and all of these things, Jesus goes, actually flip that. Okay, now you're looking at it right. Parables show us where that bias sort of lurks in us. It shows us where we've gotten stuck in a pattern of familiarity. And that really is the opportunity as we come to parables, as we let them teach us, as we let them come in and correct, which takes openness. So my question to you today is, how open are you to new ideas? See, if you weren't, you wouldn't hear it. If you were, Jesus would say, those with ears to hear, let them hear. That there's a hunger for the kingdom that drives us into the truth. There's an openness to being corrected, not just being affirmed, but willing to be shown where our lives have become incongruent with a greater reality. And Jesus is saying, I'm come that you would have life, right? To bring you to life. But that congruence with the kingdom, with eternity, with heaven, that is the key to coming alive. Then you're like in the stream. Then you're like the vine connected, or the branch connected to the vine. And what it means for us so often is to go against our sort of natural instincts. That in a world that is obsessed with power, we often think in response to God's kingdom, we should take up power and fight back, right? And so many of the parables speak right to this idea of power. How it's used, how it's held, how that is modeled. And once again, we have Jesus as the example of that, this such backwards way of thinking. The cross is so opposite of how we would strategize victory. And I was thinking about this just in general. We're going to get to our parable in just a sec. But by way of intro, in order to read these parables right, it requires us to go in Luther would say it's like riding with your opposite hand is how we have to read these parables. It's a left-handed approach. And I know that's not fair to you that are left-handed, right, my wife? It's so for Patty, it's a right-handed approach. It's coming in. Have you ever tried to write your name with the opposite hand? Right? It's impossible, right? You write slow every single movement. All these things that just so naturally occur with your right hand, right? To go with your left hand forces you into the dynamics, relearning these things. And one of my favorite guys right now is this guy, Robert Capon. And he comments about Luther's statement. And he says, left-handed power, in other words, is precisely paradoxical power. Power that looks for all the world like weakness from non-intervention. More than that, it is guaranteed to stop no determined evildoers whatsoever. It might, of course, touch and soften their hearts. But then again, it might not. It certainly didn't for Jesus. And if you decide to use it, you should be quite clear that it probably won't for you either. The only thing it does ensure is that you will not, even after your chin has been bashed in, have made the mistake of closing any interpersonal doors from your side. Isn't that interesting? He's going, all right, for the church, when you engage with the world, you're coming against power. How do you go into it in a posture like Christ that extends forgiveness? And we're going, well, yeah, what if you lead with grace and people don't receive it? And you go, right, this is basically what happened to Jesus. And yet a model is left for people where they see a truth that they can't escape. They see beauty. And that beauty speaks to these deep places of our heart. And I think this is Jesus with every single one of these parables is trying to access our heart, right? That's where the real battle is. That you have the kingdom of heaven and you got the kingdom of this world, but the battle is for the hearts of human beings. And what Jesus wants is for that kingdom to come here. That's the opportunity. And for us, it requires a posture of openness. Jesus says, would you like to grow, right? But does it force us to grow? He offers that. And in Luke 9 through 14, I think we get a nice, simple little nugget of a parable that I thought would be worth leading with. Because in this parable, you see the posture of openness revealed. To me, this is Jesus doing surgery and getting right to the heart of the matter. And so, again, as we go into a familiar passage, I want to encourage all of us to listen, but listen for the matters of our hearts. How does this speak right to me? So hear the word of the Lord. It says, Luke 19, 9 through 14. Somebody tells me it's Luke 18. Did I get that wrong? 18. How did that happen? 18. Thank you. I knew something was wrong there. Typo on my notes. Luke 18, 9 through 14. He also told this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and treated others with contempt. Two men went up into the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee, standing by himself, prayed thus, God, I thank you that I'm not like other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all that I get. But the tax collector, standing far off, would not even lift up his eyes to heaven, but beat his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, but the one who humbles himself will be exalted and exhausted. The word of the Lord. Have you heard this one? How many of you have heard this parable before? And, you know, I think when it's familiar, there's those of us that have heard this many times find ourselves praying, God, thank you that I'm not like that Pharisee. Which is to completely miss the point, isn't it? I mean, this is one of, like, lesson one with parables, is if you want to hear the truth, you're not the good guy. You're not the good guy in the story, right? That you go, the struggle here, because Jesus is showing us some moral truth, but it's not this simple little metaphor, right? It's something that's supposed to provoke. Parables subvert us, right? They come in and convict, and that's the gift of them, right? That's, we go after that. We pursue that. So when we look at the one we gravitate towards, we see that natural tendency, something in us pulls back and kind of in the left-handed way goes, how am I, how does this resemble me? Can you picture the story? I mean, this is one of the things that's great about parables is they evoke the imagination. Imagine this, what's going on here? And you can see this from a social setting, right? That Jesus is picking out these two tropes, these two symbols, right? Like what does social acceptance look like, or even social admiration? And what does it look like to be socially despised? These are our two characters, right? We have a surgeon and we have a drug dealer, right? Jesus is pulling these, because you have to understand, and you've heard this before, tax collector was like the worst of the worst of the worst in everybody's eyes. Because these people were not only working for the enemy, but they were exploiting, they were doing so by exploiting their own people and making a profit off it. They were war profiteers in that sense, but they did it by betraying their own people. The Romans would have looked at these people as a disgrace. Their own people would have looked at them with the worst of contempt. Versus the Pharisee, the religious leader, the guy who's got it all dialed in. Here's the thing, that Pharisee, as he describes himself, is probably accurate and that he's not breaking any of these rules. He really is, has this sort of integrity in how he behaves. And not just that, he's praying about it. And not just that, he's giving God credit for it. Do you hear that in his prayer? God, thank you. I thank you, God, that I'm not like these other guys. Like, thank you for making me so good. And in this, I think part of the conviction is there's a version of this that we all sort of love and aspire to. It looks right. We look at this sort of Christian model of authority, and it conveys security. It conveys talent and ability. These Pharisees were brilliant and smart, and everything looked right. All the appearances were there. But you can see through the cracks, there's an underlying self-sufficiency. There's an underlying self-righteousness, or as Jesus is going to say, somebody who trusts in himself. That's the warning. That's the seed that comes in and corrupts faith. And how dangerous this is, this seed, when it spreads. And it reveals itself in the comparison. Thank you that I'm not like them, right? That its whole standard of measurement is like standing up next to the guy on either side and seeing, like, how do I look? How do I measure up? Does anybody here do that? It is so hard to not do that, to measure that ruler that we have of comparison. It's kind of like all we know how to do. And our feeling of value, we measure, what sort of effect does it have? What sort of splash do I make? How many people care what I have to say? That's the measure of worth. Which means we're always sort of pumping ourselves up, always sort of knocking somebody else down. And we'll even pray that way and not even realize that we've fallen into this trap. See, that's again the gift of this parable. It calls out these symptoms and it shows us the root. When we judge or blame, when we hold other people in contempt, when we look down our nose at somebody, Jesus is saying, you're doing it. And it's pride. What Lewis calls the complete anti-God state of mind. Like, pride is the cancer. It's the thing that gets out there. It's the thing that detaches us from the source. And so Jesus shows us an example of it and goes, hey, this thing that you probably naturally admire, even gravitate towards, that's actually, there you go, that's the... This is sort of the enemy of the story here, the enemy of the truth. If this is bad religion, as it turns out. The one that you think is justified isn't. And the other one, this one looking down, beating his chest, who can't even make eye contact. This tax collector, what is he feeling, do you think? What would you say? Name the emotions here. What's shame? What else?
Guilt,
embarrassment.
Disgust.
Regret.
Empty.
Lonely.
Rich.
Yes. Can you identify with any of those feelings? Maybe even anguish. And to me, I think as Jesus is inviting us into the heart, he shows it in all its like rawness exposed. And all these things that this tax collector is feeling are probably true as well. And Jesus is saying, if you want to come into this kingdom, this is the way to do it. Right there in all that stuff. I don't know about you, but when I'm watching a movie and there's a moment of shame or anguish, I go, does anybody need anything to eat? And I go to the kitchen and grab something and come back and like, okay, scene's over. Like, who wants to sit in any of that, right? But the truth is, like, so much of humanity is experiencing moments like this where we are at our most raw. And I say this because I think sometimes this Pharisee, what he's done is he's created this whole persona around something that he sees as lovable. And what he's trying to avoid is the fact that his heart and this tax collector's heart are basically, when laid bare, the same. Broken, desperate, hurting, and in pain. I just heard the other day that these sort of negative emotions affect our brain in the same way that physical pain does. So to sit there, he's beating his breast, right? But you're going inside, his brain is responding to all the regret in the very same way. It's pain. Crying out for mercy. And we don't do these negative emotions, do we, right? We want to run to the fix, run to the answer, run to that thing. When God talks about this idea of like the light shining in the darkness, and how does the darkness respond to the light? So often we run back into the shadows. And why do we do that? It's because often we don't like what we see. And so we spend all our time creating this persona that's lovable. And Jesus is going, hey, just so you know, in God's kingdom, that's a waste of time. It is a waste of time. I like how Thomas Merton says this false self is like wrapping bandages around this invisible person trying to give it form. And he says in there, and I think this is brilliant, he goes, guess that what? That person? God doesn't love that person because it's not actually a person. There's nothing there, right? This false persona, God's like, I don't even know that person. But he turns to the tax collector and he goes, I know you. I know that heart. And in all that brokenness where we recoil because it's hard to enter into somebody else's uncomfortability, God draws near to the brokenhearted. God draws near to the one with shame and regret. And as that person pleads for mercy, God pours out mercy. And this is the beauty in the story, right? This is the kind of beauty that can save the world. Is that God doesn't recoil at that brokenness. He's moved with compassion to go towards it. And when we live in this world of comparison and judgment towards others and excluding, and what about them, and those are the bad guys over there, all we're doing is insulating ourselves from the thing our hearts crave the most, which is that belonging and that love of God. It's the futility of that project. The prideful, self-sufficient project fails in the end. But how much time and effort do we, even as followers of Christ, spend in that sort of religious game? I read this quote from Henry Nouwen that I thought, oh gosh, it's so good. He says, much Christian leadership is exercised by people who do not know how to develop healthy, intimate relationships and have opted for power and control instead. Many Christian empire builders have been people unable to give and receive love. And I think that's kind of what you see there in this, is a Pharisee who cannot give and receive love. He's cut off and he's withering. And so the invitation of this parable, this riddle, it comes in there, right? And it exposes our game, exposes all the way we look for affirmation. Exposes our own sort of narcissism that's in there. I read this definition of hubris. Credit to Brené Brown for this. She says, hubris is an inflated sense of one's own abilities that is tied to the need for dominance, that is tied more to the need for dominance than to actual accomplishments. And that relationship, right? Why is it not enough for this Pharisee to pursue living a holy life, right? He's got to shame somebody else in order to elevate that relationship. This is the kingdom of the world, right? That holds others down so that we can rise. You've heard me quote this plenty of times, but it's one of my favorites when Jesus tells Peter, this is what's going to happen and you're going to die. And Peter goes, what about John? And Jesus says lovingly, what is that to you? What about them? What about that guy? Right? And Jesus says, what is that to you? I had this walking the Camino. I had a lady that was there that was like an executive coach. And she was like, have you ever heard of this book, Positive Intelligence by Sherzad? Who said that? Yeah, nice. Okay. I hadn't heard of it. But I'm like, she's like, you got to take this test on saboteurs. And I was like, okay, whatever. You know, it's free. Fine. I wasn't that cynical, but I was like, you know, you feel that little bit of resistance, right? So I take this test on exposing your saboteurs. And I'm reading through this afterwards. You know, here, Jeff, here's your top three. Think you're a victim. You avoid conflict. And you're hyper-analytical. And I was like, you're stupid. It's like, this book is ridiculous, right? Like, and you, like, you look at that and go, is that good or bad, right? No, that's good to welcome this in and to listen, to know these things about ourselves. It's a gift, like Jesus is going, like, walk in the light. Walk in truth, right? You're like, I actually kind of like these stories that I tell myself. God, thank you for making me this, whatever it is, Jeff's version. And God's going, I don't love that guy, Jeff. It's like your little made-up thing over here. But I love you. I love you. Like so much. And how we cut ourselves off from that in all the performance. I have this picture, and I'm not going to put it up, but it's like this picture that I have of these three ladies that walked to the Camino with me. And I can't tell you, I find it really emotional because I wasn't a pastor on this trip. I was just Jeff, right? I just walked this journey with these group of people. And these three ladies at the very end just came up and gave me this embrace. My wife, I think, was the one who took the picture. But there's just so much affection. And I look at it and I go, oh, it's affection just for me, not for my title or not for some function that I serve. It's just Jeff there, right? But I showed that picture to my spiritual director and she goes, does God love you that much? And I'm like, oh. She's like, you just need to, Jeff, just sit with that, right? That I worry so much about that, or so much of my life can become motivated by this, or wanting to look successful, or have these things in line, or making sure that my kids' lives are perfect, and everything's squared away. And really, in the end, I think Jesus is going, it's that person there in the rawness of who they are that can receive that love. And that love is everything. That when that is right, the rest of this flows. Are we called to live lives of integrity? Of course we are. Are we called to shine and to live lives of holiness? Absolutely. Does God want to correct our sin and our lack of virtue? He does. He wants to come in and heal all of that. But it's by getting down to that very core, which this posture of recognizing that we can't fix ourselves. That we are that desperate and that needy. But that what happens is when we open our hearts up like that, that love just comes right in. That love that says you are forgiven. I was listening to something this week where they were saying humility, right? Which is what you see here at the heart of this broken man is this moment of humility. And they were saying that humility is crucial to experience like two of the greatest emotions that we can experience in this world, which is wonder and awe. The way into those two is humility. Only when we are in that place of open-handedness are we able to be moved in wonder and in awe. The beauty comes in and speaks right to our hearts of that worth. So do you see the futility of this game when we're holding that at bay, right? That the pride is holding that love at bay, even like doubtful that it's as good as it is. And when that comes down, what stirs in our hearts is wonder and awe. This is what God wants us to see in ourselves. And then, in order to carry out that mission, to see that in others. When we look in others, we see not with this criticism, judgment, and blame. We see what God sees. The gift of this love, this commission, this being salt, is to bring that out in others. And what does that do? That gives us like the real meaning that we seek. That is the real work. That is the impeded stream starting to sing, right? That is the beauty that comes. I have some questions for you, of course. And then we'll eat lasagna out on the patio together. What's that? And then come over. Question one, how do you feel about growth? Thinking on just a real basic level, as we consider the parables, we consider going forward, how do you feel about growth? Is it exciting? Is it terrifying? Is it threatening? What things draw you in? What things cause you to withdraw? Yeah, growth and change. I mean, these things go hand in hand, don't they? And like part of us is like, I just want some stability right now. But we have this invitation to grow. For those who have ears to hear. Number two, how aware are you when you are experiencing negative emotions? How do you respond? I just heard somebody say that in the midst of our emotions, we generally are only aware of, most people are only aware of three different emotions as they're experiencing it: mad, sad, and glad. But some of these other emotions, I think sometimes we're not even paying attention. We don't see ourselves avoid. But two, how aware are you when you're experiencing negative emotions? And how do you respond? Do you avoid, defend, rationalize, compare, judge? What would it be like to sit with those feelings, name them, acknowledge them, and then take them to God? To let those feelings come through us and out, right? The freedom of being in there, being present, and letting them go. I like how Teresa of Avila says, we sit in our weeds with God. Sitting in our weeds with God. Number three, have you ever experienced the freedom of forgiveness, grace, and mercy? Have you? Have you ever experienced that? And think about it. Picture a time where you experienced grace and you experienced forgiveness or somebody showed you mercy. And think about what that felt like. Imagine that moment. How does it make you feel in your body? What if we connected the invitation to grow with those emotions of grace and freedom? Does that make sense? The opportunity to grow, God is saying, is the opportunity to be free. That the truth sets us free. The truth we connect with in that place of vulnerability is the grace of God. And that grace brings freedom. Number four, kind of a hard one, but is there anything you want to ask for forgiveness for right now? I heard that. Somebody said yes. Let's just take a moment and pause. If there's something there on your heart, just take a moment and like this man with his eyes down, beating his breast, ask God for his mercy. Because he's faithful to forgive. And as we close, let me just read these last two verses over all of us. This reminder that the Lord is gracious and merciful, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love. The Lord is good to all. And his mercy is over all that he has made. Amen.